Hey everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of Neighbor Science.
Yeah, we're finally doing a capitalist power episode, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah. We've been dying to do this one, and we've been literally the hundreds and thousands of fan mail. I rediscovered that real mail exists because of the capitalist power episodes that we've been teasing.
Yeah, my PO box is just stuffed to the rafters.
Dude, I've been getting I've actually been asked by the Bahraini government to cease and desist because their postal service can't keep up. I mean, we're a small island. We don't have that kind of capacity anymore. If everyone could just please switch to email, Google has the infrastructure to deal with it.
No. Yeah, we're environmentalists, and you guys are single-handedly causing deforestation because of all the mail we're getting from you guys. I mean, we appreciate the love, but, you know, at some point I need to get my Penny Saver catalog, and I can't do that if my P.O. box is always full, so stop it.
Yeah. Also, my letter opener is now blunt, and I don't know where to get it sharpened, and I'm too much of a modern tech whiz, so I know how to open email. Letters are causing me problems, and I'm tired of paper cuts. So,
I can't believe you guys don't have a letter opener store there. That's crazy to me. I cannot imagine life without one.
Exactly. I do come from a non-Middle Eastern country where we have letter opener stores every few blocks, to be honest, but there's nothing here, so I'm kind of at loss.
If it weren't for that, the wakizashi shaped letter opener that I inherited from my dad would just be completely dull by now.
Fortunately,
I can keep that piece of Japanese culture alive in my house. So
I'm actually thinking of ordering in bulk via online Walmart, so that even when it goes blunt, I can pass it down to someone else's children.
Well, you'd be a real job creator if you did that. So,
exactly. Okay, so today Ryan and myself, Peter, are going to be discussing the work of Jonathan Mitzan and Simson Bichler. I never say it right, and these are important people whose names should be said right.
Yeah, I think it's Bichler. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Apparently I pronounce everything wrong, so
yeah.
I'm just gonna embrace pronouncing things wrong.
we've been told by certain individuals that I speak funny because I'm not American. And
well, that's
Ryan
just objectively true. I mean, you do speak funny.
Yeah, but no one laughs. Goofball. No one laughs, and so I don't think that they're using the word funny right, and so
you're like
poo-poo on that.
Oi, I'm going out with me mates. That's what you sound like.
That is so far away from what I sound like. No, I don't sound like that at all, mate. Not at all.
Throw some shrimp on the barbie. That's what you sound like.
Yeah. That's a tinny day, mate. Just a small wee one. So we're discussing the work of Bichler and Nitzan, where they wrote a wonderful piece. When was the book written?
2007. And the reason I know that is because it came out right before the global recession.
God.
They had to add an amendment like a year after it came out and be like, yeah, so we didn't really expect the recession to happen like right after we published this. So here's some more material that talks about it.
And I'll tell you what a brilliant theory to be able to explain what happened in 2007 and you know, give us a reference frame that actually makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, essentially, if we were to give the elevator pitch for capitalist power, I would simply go on to say that capitalist power looks at the field of political economy and comes to the relatively obvious, although it was as obvious to me before, why I thought that neoclassical economics and Marxist economics is essentially wrong. But they spend the book basically in detail explaining why it's wrong and doesn't work properly or not as advertised. And then they give a slightly different version of political economy that gives us something that can be empirically looked at. And in this reference frame, we can then say that capital is power, that it is a mode of power, a form of power.
I think we need to workshop this elevator pitch a little bit.
Oh, yeah, it was a really big building, and I had like 43 floors.
You're in Dubai? Dubai elevator pitch. If we were in the Burj Dubai, this would be just so brief. It'd be like a quarter of the elevator ride. I would say it's a method of analyzing capitalism I would say it's not slightly different. I would say that it's radically different. It's a radically different way of analyzing capitalism to see that capitalism is a system of managing power, and that capital itself is a way of calculating and like sort of optimizing the management of power through quantitative or quantification, rather. That was brief, yeah. I think.
Yeah, brief, but I'm not sure it was much better than mine. And like, I think if we were to workshop those two together and take out the fluffy bits, then we'd be left mostly with yours. But I think some of the things I said could fit in there.
Yeah. Maybe. I usually just leave out the Marxist, mentioning the other, yeah, those two things, yeah. I just leave those out because, whatever.
look, for me, those are important simply because it's difficult to get people out of the dichotomy of either you're left or you're right, or either you're a capitalist or you're a socialist.
Yeah, what Peter's saying is there's problems on both sides.
Yeah, and there are and the
both sides
is
are equally bad.
yeah, that's totally what I'm saying. We should totally give both sides an equal platform to talk.
Yeah, the truth is somewhere in the middle. We need Marxism and neoclassical economics, and that's where capitalist power comes in. It's the balance between supply and demand and labor theory of value.
Jeez, I don't even want to know how badly Nitzan would have a heart attack if he even for a second thought that someone was busy saying that his work advocated centrism. This is the brand new Hillary Clinton platform.
Yeah. This is brought to you by Anarchists for Hillary Clinton. That was actually a subvertisement on the back of one of the zines I put out.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it was a quote from, it was either Bookchin or Nitzan. And there's a picture of Hillary Clinton with like gold sunglasses and like, you know, rose gold iPhone that she was staring at. And then it says paid for by Anarchists for Hillary Clinton at the bottom.
I like it.
I gave it to someone and they had no idea what level of irony I was on. So they were like, what the fuck is this?
Okay. So just to lead into this, the book starts with a quote by Cecilia Payne, the astrophysicist.
And it's Hillary warned us.
God. No, I need a straight face because this is a really beautiful quote, in my opinion. It's one of the best I've ever come across. And it basically, it's quick, it's easy. She said, "There is no joy more intense than that of coming upon a fact that cannot be understood in terms of currently accepted ideas."
Damn, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
I know, right? And this is essentially the premise of capitalist power is if you go look at all the actual data available to economists and political economists specifically today, none of it really fits the prevailing theories of everything that try to explain capitalism. Whereas Nitzan and Bichler basically looked at the data and said, well, let's use the data to derive an explanation. And yeah, that's what we're going to get into now.
Yeah. So we're going to start with why capitalist power? Why should we care about capitalist power? What's the reason for its existence? So to start, no existing theory can explain or define capital in any adequate sense.
Look, lots of them try and they sort of make a theory and then rationalize every time they come up against a barrier that basically says, no, that doesn't match reality.
I'm convinced that once capitalist power becomes more widely known, Marxists are going to say, oh, yeah, well, of course. We've been saying that the whole time.
Yeah,
so if you ask a Marxist to define capital for you, they'll basically say that capital is means of production. Or if you keep pushing... especially to a like a very orthodox Marxist, they will say, well, actually, the entire book Capital is defining capital. You can't define it in simple terms. It's the entire system that Marx defined.
Yeah, they do think of it as the entire set of social relations. And I'm like, wait, how is that different from... capitalists and pro-capitalists saying no.
How is capital different from capitalism if it's the entire set of social relations? And also, why do capitalists, who are the people managing capital, why do they disagree with you? Neoclassical economics, on the other hand, which for those who don't know, for those who aren't cool like me and read economics, even though you're not in school and never studied it in school. Neoclassical economics is the prevailing school of thought in economics. It's a sort of Newtonian productivist theory of capitalism that seeks to explain everything in capitalism through the lens of supply and demand, which is, you know, just basically a force of nature that equilibrates the conflicts in capitalism to produce optimally efficient allocation. It's clearly bullshit. You know, anyone who's spent even 1 minute in a job knows that it's not true at all. But unfortunately for us, economists don't get real jobs. They're usually economists their entire lives, so they never have to do anything that resembles real work. But anyway, neoclassical economics considers capital to just be stuff. I'm going to read from the Wikipedia definition. In economics, capital consists of anything that can enhance a person's power to perform economically useful work. Capital goods, real capital, or capital assets are already produced durable goods or any non-financial asset that is used in the production of goods and services. So they actually... consider capital goods to be explicitly non-financial, which is very strange. But according to this extremely stupid definition, this means that a hammer is capital, a pen is capital, comfortable shoes are capital. And well, this is not just me interpreting the definition uncharitably to point out how incredibly bad it is, because I think this is from Investopedia. It says, in a fundamental sense, capital consists of anything that can enhance a person's power to perform economically useful work. A stone or an arrow is capital for a caveman who can use it as a hunting instrument, and roads are capital for inhabitants of a city. So they literally think that capital has always existed, and that anything that makes you able to do work better is capital.
So by this definition, a motivational speech or a pep talk is capital.
Yeah. It wouldn't be a capital good, but it would be capital. A break is capital. Taking a break is capital.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like the libertarian reductionist definition of capitalism, which is just like capitalism is trade, or if it, the even worse one is capitalism is just freedom, because
I love that argument.
Not being coerced is an exchange. When you're talking to your friend, that's an exchange. Capitalism. If you're having sex with your girlfriend, that's exchange. That's capitalism. But when the government gets involved, that's communism.
But I mean, that's obvious.
Pretty great stuff.
Obviously, any time that your freedom gets removed, it's commies. And any time that freedom gets added, it's capitalism.
Yeah. So
capitalism is actually ancient Hutu. For freedom. So, yeah. Like, obviously, that's directly where the word comes from.
Yeah, yeah. Ubuntu means communism, and capitalism means freedom.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And like, silly Africans.
No. So, to return to Marxists, Marxist economics have varying definitions of capital. The more modern school, or the more like populist definition would be means of production, or technomass, which is a term used in the CASP community quite a bit. Technomass, as in like the machines in a factory, that kind of thing. This is a slightly less horrendously awful definition, but it's still very bad, just because it's not correct at all according to empirical evidence of capitalism. The more orthodox school, again, consider capital to be the entire set of social relations described in Capital, which, once again, what's the difference between capital and capitalism then? So the critical problem isn't so much with the definition itself of means of production as with trying to use it analytically. Capitalists don't actually care about means of production, and owning means of production, as we discussed two episodes ago, is not the key factor in capitalist control of the social sphere. So I've pointed this out to Marxists in the past, and they will often try to get around this by saying, yeah, well, you know, if it weren't for their ownership of the means of production, then they wouldn't have any control of this sphere of social relations. But no, because you can own the means of production and still be controlled by a capitalist, as we discussed in the Firmhood episode. The other major issue is that analytical Marxism uses socially necessary abstract labor time, which we will shorten to SNALT from now on.
Which is beautiful, by the way. Just being what? Able to say snalt whenever I talk to a Marxist makes me very happy.
Yeah, I wish that were just a real word. It's very aesthetically pleasing to me. Yes. So the problem with snalt is, one, it's unobservable and immeasurable, because the only way you can measure labor is in hours. Otherwise, you fall into the trap of different types of labor have, you know, different values, or they produce different things. So you can't define a unit of labor unless you consider all labor to be equally valuable. And Marxists don't really consider all labor to be equally valuable.
No, they don't.
They actually distinguish between productive and unproductive labor. But once you do this, you have the problem of how in an organization do you actually make this distinction? This is also known as the value chain problem, because in a practical organization, there's a lot of people that are not directly involved in the production of a commodity, and the organization still requires them doing their job in order to run. And so how do you separate them from the productive process? And then even if you can do that qualitatively, how do you do it quantitatively? Mm. If you have someone who, maintains the assembly line, like a maintenance guy, or a maintenance girl, or a maintenance non-binary person, how do you quantify their input in terms of the commodity? Because if you have like five people working on an assembly line and they produce, X number of products and it costs Y dollars, you can say, X times Y divided by five or whatever, divided by the number of people. That's how much each person contributed. But if you throw in this maintenance person, maybe they only work in that building like, twice a year because they only come in when the equipment breaks down. But without them, it would be impossible for you to do your work. So how do you quantify their input into the organization? Because that is socially necessary labor. It's not like you can just ignore it. It's impossible to really make that work in practice. And then the last problem is the transformation problem. How do you go from units of snalt to units of money?
You just go to the snalt store thing.
Yeah, you go to the bank, you put in a request for Forex, and then they you trade in, you give them your units of snalt, and then they give you dollars. That's how it works.
That's how I've always done it. I've always just taken in my pieces of IOU paper that I've written down.
That you got in your commune?
Yeah. Okay, so, I think that a really good example of why neither of these schools of thought, your Marxist or your neoclassical, the most obvious example for why they're wrong, for me, is some stuff that was said probably quite a few times now, but in the last week or two, Trump went on Twitter and spoke about how the U.S. has a $500 billion trade deficit. And for those who don't understand what a trade deficit is, that's when more of the economy is leaving than is coming in, specifically referring to the U.S. now. But in order to make that figure, Trump had to go and focus purely on goods and purely on goods and manufacturing. The actual total, if you take into account the other 80% of the U.S. economy, which is service based, specifically finance and that kind of stuff, the trade deficit then drops down to something like 300 million if you take the whole thing into account, because there is no trade deficit when you look at the service economy in the U.S. It's an overall surplus. And this to me illustrates very acutely the problem with both theories. Neoclassicists won't consider financial services as capital, and Marxists won't consider anything that is the finished product to be capital. It's only the stuff that makes that stuff. So in both cases, they would kind of have to go and say, well, okay, yeah, Trump's number is the correct number. And they'd be misfiguring the entire economy just as badly as Trump does.
Yeah. Neoclassical economists might get around it by their silly definition of service, which is a good that is consumed immediately. That's literally what they say.
Wait, really?
Yeah, they say a service is a good that is consumed immediately. Yep. That's what neoclassicals think.
That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of deep-seated problems with their theories, and so they've had about a whole century to come up with increasingly insane fibs about reality to keep up the appearance,
Ryan,
that they're correct.
How the fuck can they possibly think that insurance is consumed immediately?
Because they don't actually use the real world to examine things. They just, like, put it into their fucking model. And they're like, say you're on a desert island, and that's how they always think. So they don't use real life to back up their theories, because their theories would fall apart immediately.
Okay, so obviously in the neoclassical view, then the two of us are on an island, and
coconuts and I have bananas.
But mine are insurance coconuts and yours are finance chickens. and we can trade the finance chickens for insurance coconuts if we use shell currency.
I don't know. I think the way that they see it is, like, they would consider a service, like, a good example of a service to be like, you pay me $5 a month, and I give you an apple, and you eat that apple right there.
Wait, what?
Yeah. that's what I'm guessing. That's what I'm guessing they perceive services to be, is like, a service is just paying someone to provide you a good that you then consume right on the spot.
Oh my god.
I think that's what they think. But anyway, some asshole's probably going to tell me that I'm wrong for this, so let's move on.
Regardless, though, the fact is that capital is not what either of these two groups consider capital to be.
Yeah. So they can't explain or define capital. They'll be wrong.
Okay. Can they, if they can't explain capital, can they explain prices?
No. So two of the most important things in capitalism, things that make capitalism what it is, are capital, obviously, which is the central element of capitalism, and price, which is the system that capitalism uses to manage itself. The thing that you interact with, if you are interacting with a capitalist, is going to be on the basis of prices. So either buying commodities or selling your time as an employee. Either way, you have a price, which is either the price of the commodity or the wage that you're paid. So neither neoclassical economists nor Marxist economists can actually explain how prices are actually formed and what they represent. Neoclassicals and Marxist economists both think that capitalists are price takers. That is, they individually have no power to influence prices. That prices are just formed by this self-equilibrating process, and capitalists just observe what the price is, you know, sort of pluck it out of the air and then slap it onto their commodities or their the wages that they pay.
So they both basically believe in some, I don't know, supernatural, invisible...
Yeah, some heteronomous force that I mean, neoclassicals, I think, believe in a heterotomous force in capitalism. I think that Marx has probably acknowledged that the force is socially constructed, but that it somehow still follows these like laws of nature, because otherwise they would have to reject this socially necessary abstract labor time thing.
Sounds midichlorian to me, but okay.
So underlying the assumption of price taking is the assumption that there's perfect competition, or at least approximately so. Neoclassicals today, even though they don't believe in perfect equilibrium, they believe in what this thing called dynamic stochastic general equilibrium, or DSGE. And it's basically like, okay, you thoroughly disproved that that the strict equilibrium can apply. You've thoroughly disproved that that approximate equilibrium can apply in the specific case. But if you look in the long run, then there's this approximate equilibrium that we can see, and you know, there's certain points in time for the entire economy when it actually is an equilibrium, even if sometimes it's not an equilibrium due to all these outside distortions, which, you know, sure, the distortions vastly outweigh and outnumber the equilibriums, but you know, capitalism is still governed by equilibriums. I mean, come on, let's be serious here, guys.
Just one second before you carry on. Weren't you recently told that you were pulling out of Fallacy of Composition by someone on Twitter?
Yes.
But do they realize that that is a fallacy of composition?
No, and it's funny because if you go on Wikipedia and look up fallacy of composition, which I did because I was like, do I remember correctly what this is? Because I cannot, for the life of me, figure out how this applies to what I just said. If you look on that article, almost all of the examples that they have are from economics, and not like not economics is making fallacies of composition. That the explanations that economics has for things are correcting fallacies of composition.
Oh God.
Yeah, the most basic fallacy of composition is that if one person specializing in something is good, then everyone should specialize in that thing. When really we should have a division of labor, as Adam Smith taught us. We need to have a division of labor so we can have pin factories.
Yeah, it literally does. Oh my God.
Yeah, it's really
bad. And this, dear people, is why you do not use Wikipedia as a primary source of anything.
So for neoclassicals, prices are taken from the equilibrium of supply and demand. So they think that that supply and demand balances out in this equilibrium, and at the point of equilibrium, you have the objectively correct price to efficiently and optimally manage resources.
What's funny for me about all of this is that it's extremely circular. And at no point do they acknowledge the fact that they need prices in order to establish supply and to establish demand, so that they can then use supply and demand to establish prices. Wait, what?
Well, it's funny because you know, most people think of it as there is X amount of supply and Y amount of demand, and at the intersection of the two, you have the price that is paid. But actually, if you look at the statement of what the model is, it's given a price, capitalists will supply X amount of goods, and consumers will demand Y amount of goods. So it's
literally
precisely backwards from what most people think it is.
Yeah.
So the price just sort of materializes out of thin air. And at that price,
it is for the record, that price is handed down to capitalists by a
beneficent ruler,
by a beneficent imaginary hand.
Yeah.
An
invisible pink hand.
An invisible pink, slightly peachy, definitely not brown hand.
Doesn't like spicy stuff very much.
Salt and pepper are spices to white people.
No, too
okay?
spicy. Salt is too spicy.
My wife is going to love that one. Yeah. I absolutely love snolty food. I've been dying to say it. And also kind of
so you like for once, like when more work has been put into food. That's reasonable. Yeah.
Yeah. And I come from a hospitality background.
What's the snaltiest food?
The snaltiest food is almost
Texas barbecue, I think.
No.
Yeah, you have to like sit there at the smoker for like 24 hours straight.
Nah, I don't think that qualifies as labor just because you're sitting there for a long time. The actual labor involved.
Value chain problem much?
Yeah, exactly. So go read your notes on temporalism, boy. Okay, we have gotten way off track.
No, we're right on track.
We're supposed to be talking about, what are we talking about?
Supply and demand, prices.
Prices, that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And why they're stupid. And
I see
no
here
sense.
That I wrote all prices, and then I stopped.
I looked at your notes, and I was like, you know what? He's right. All prices are a problem.
That's a good point. Yeah, so we already talked about neoclassical economists. So for Marxist economists, prices are taken from snalt. And this, likewise, is actually a statement that capitalists are price takers and that economic competition is perfect. Because otherwise, capitalists would be able to influence prices so that they're not explained by snalt. So if they were not price takers, there would be no real reason for prices to be connected to any of like reality of production. And that's typically how Marxists explain capitalism, is that even though it is a bad system, ultimately it is governed by the realities of production, which is why exploitation, et cetera, exist. Neither theory, neoclassical or Marxist, is particularly empirical. Marxists, I think, definitely try to be more empirical, like with Piketty's work recently. That was a good empirical work. But neoclassicals, on the other hand, make almost no effort to do this. Neither school of thought actually goes to businesses and talks to the people that actually form prices, because prices are formed by people, and ask them hey, how do you decide what your price is? What's the logic that goes into it? How often do you do it? Neoclassicals didn't start doing this until the 90s. And I don't mean the 1890s, I mean the 1990s. They didn't start doing this until about 20 years ago. I guess it's almost 30 years ago now. Jesus.
Getting old, Ryan.
I don't think Marxists have ever done this. I'm not aware of any Marxist study that talked to people that actually work in businesses and decide what prices are. Actually, now that I think about it, a childhood friend of mine, his wife, her job is actually setting the prices for flights for Delta. So I should talk to her and ask her what her logic is and what procedures that she follows. I know she does it every day because airline prices change constantly, but I would be interested to know. Maybe I should just have her on the show.
Maybe. We are busy planning or we have spoken about having more guests on for those of you that are keen to join. Okay, I think that in order for us to make our way through this episode at a more solid pace, I think we need to start discussing capitalization. But before we can do that, we would have to discuss like production prices versus capitalization.
I think we can skip that. Let's just skip over it because it's I didn't take many notes on it. I kind of glossed over it in the book on my reread. So we'll just jump straight into what is capital.
Ryan, I don't give you homework so that you can slack off, okay?
So what is capital? What is capitalization? Capital, as I mentioned before, it's the central element of capitalism. We know that capitalists... I'm going to say that again. We know that capitalists accumulate capital. What is actually being accumulated, though? According to neoclassicals, they would say that it's utils, and utils are a measurement of utility. Yes, they think that there's a literal particle called a util. But obviously there isn't. Marxists believe it to be snalt or embodied labor, which is required to create value. So ultimately, both believe that capital accumulation is just the accumulation of productive capacity or useful stuff. In reality, capital is a claim on earnings. So there's a quote that Bickler and Nitzan used from Graham and Dodd. I don't actually know who those people are. I'm just citing the quote. And it says, the value of a common stock depends entirely upon what it will earn in the future. So capital is based on future value. Not present value. Capitalization tells us how much a capitalist would be prepared to pay now to receive a flow of money later. An example that Bickler and Nitzan use is a $1,000 payment due in a year's time and discounted at a 5% rate of interest would have a present value of $952.38. Capitalization, in terms of a formally defined and understood thing, didn't become fully accepted until the 1950s. So before then, capitalists were sort of implicitly discounting, but in terms of like their actual accounting practices, they were using historical cost accounting. So they did not formalize capitalization until the 1950s. And I'm trying to remember what the actual person was that started this. It doesn't matter. You're not going to know who he is anyway. So we'll just
read the book. Keep going. Read the book.
Yeah, read the book. So after capitalization became accepted, budgeting by capitalists used net present value, which is just a restatement of future value discounted to present value. And assets used the capital asset pricing model. And then later on, the fairly famous, I believe he's a general, McNamara. he brought capitalization into the military. So they started thinking of their investments in terms of future value instead of present value.
But Ryan, that can't be right. That can't be right. Capitalism is anti-state, and the military is the state. So, like, no, it can't be right. You're going against the notion of capitalism being freedom.
All right, sorry guys, we were wrong. That's the end of the episode and of the podcast. Bye. Today, capitalization has advanced to every aspect of our lives, including life itself. So as examples of capitalists capitalizing life, there's personal loans, which capitalize on labor. So when a worker gets a loan for a house or a car, they give up part of their future income for present wealth. So when you take on a loan, you are saying to a capitalist, I will give you this amount of all of my income in the future in return for you giving me a lump of money now. And
just to be clear, that those future earnings that you are giving the capitalist are, it's always more than what you're getting in the present.
Right. And that's because of the discount. And in addition, you can't give up more than you will earn in the future. So a capitalist will not give you a loan that they know that you can't pay with your future income. So if you know that, you know, you're going to be making $9 an hour from now until, 10 years from now or whatever, capitalists will not give you a loan that would require you to have $11 an hour of income.
Yeah, they're banking on the fact that there will be no rise in the minimum income.
Man, the damn neighbor's cat keeps coming up to my house, trying to get inside, just staring at me and meowing. He's really cute,
No, dude, like, you cat people, you don't understand this. He's not trying to be cute or anything. He's busy casing the joint so that he can murder you in your sleep. Cats are evil. And
oh, I know, but that's cute to me. I mean, the face that he makes while he's doing that is just adorable. All right, he's already going away now.
You're lucky.
So another example of capitalization of life. I'm really good at talking today. Insurance, like health insurance, capitalizes on the body. So the business model of insurance is that they will take in more in premiums than they will have to pay out in insurance payments. So they are capitalizing on the fact that your body will not break down as much as fast as you pay them to maintain it.
Yeah, for the record, insurance company CEOs, their bonuses are based
human on organs.
They're that's funny, but their bonuses are based on the rate at which they don't pay out.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the entire industry is based on them not having to pay out for the actual thing that they're supposed to be helping you afford.
Yeah. I mean, the insurance model is let the many pay for the few.
Yeah. So finally, biotech companies, which have only emerged in the last few decades, capitalize on the actual genome of life itself. And this requires, you know, a system of patents on genomes.
Yeah.
Which are fairly controversial, but...
Yeah, turning...
Not going away anytime soon?
Turning actual physical genomes into intellectual property, that's one hell of a value transformation there.
Yeah. So Marx described capital in the sense of capitalization as fictitious capital. So in the book, they say... they summarize his idea, and they say actual capital exists as commodities, as in means of production, work in progress, and commodity money, whose prices are governed by labor time, whether historical or current. So according to Marx, actual capital is capital whose price is governed by snalt. Fictitious capital, on the other hand, is merely ownership claims on earnings. So Marx acknowledged that fictitious capital has a distortionary effect on prices as governed by labor theory of value and snalt. But this fundamentally undermines labor theory of value and thus any analysis that depends on how prices are formed, because if there's a distortion, then how do you account for the distortion? And like, if you look at a price, how do you know whether it's distorted or not? How do you know how much of it is explained by labor and how much of it is explained by this distortionary fictitious capital.
It's amazing to me how much information they derive from a number.
Yeah, yeah.
A contextless number.
As Beckler and Nitzan put it, the net result is to leave Marxists with no scientific theory of capitalization, and therefore neither a unique explanation for, nor an alternative to, the actual capitalism of the present.
As I pointed out earlier, is 80% service-based. Yeah. And by services, we can now go on to say stuff like finance.
Right. And just to make this clear, describing the laws of motion as both Marxists and neoclassicals try to do is a fundamentally futile task, because capital and capitalism are human systems. There is no reason for them to behave according to natural laws. Other than like what is technically possible for it to do, because it's a construct, it's a social construct, not a natural system. So there can be patterns and regularities, but these are primarily the result of common behaviors by capitalists, and they could change for various reasons.
Yeah.
Such as them formalizing the idea of capitalization and changing the way that they account for things. That would be a fundamental change in the patterns and regularities of capitalism that was fueled purely by a change in what they believe. Let's see, moving on to capital. I think I can move on. I'm trying to see if I covered everything.
Yeah, I think you covered everything. I just wanted to point out that earlier on you said that neoclassical economics is very Newtonian. And like whenever I read about Snalt or I read about Utils or any of these particles of economics, it does feel very Newtonian. And just to be clear, I mean like Isaac Newton believing that everything that the entire universe was filled with a luminiferous ether instead of what we now understand to be actual physics. Don't get me wrong, Newtonian physics is fine if you want to very generally sort of get the gist of what's going on. But the moment you start looking at the nitty-gritty and you try and figure out the details, you need relativity, you need quantum mechanics, you need actual empirical theories that are able to calculate stuff quantitatively. And it translates perfectly into economics, where they're okay if you want to sort of generally describe more or less what's going on. But the moment you start looking at very specific examples and you start looking at very specific situations and real world happenings, these generalisms don't apply anymore. They don't function. They don't tell us anything meaningful.
I think the best example of Newtonian ideas in capitalism is for both supply and demand, because supply and demand doesn't work perfectly. Each good has a different level of change when there's a change in supply or demand. They change at different paces, and the way that they term this is the price elasticity of demand. So they literally think that it's like an elastic behavior where the rate of change in a price due to changes in supply and demand is like a property of the good, an inherent property of the good that can be quantified in terms of elasticity, the way that the amount that something stretches like physically can be quantified by an elasticity. So we're getting off track again. Let's keep going.
By the way, I have been considering us changing the show's name from Neighbor Science to Jesus, we're off track again.
So again, capital is based on future value. So because the future is unknown, there's uncertainty and risk involved in capitalization and setting the price of capital. Capitalists use current earnings and their trajectory as a guidepost for estimating future earnings. But this doesn't mean that the trend of capitalization necessarily follows the trend of earnings. Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, or sometimes it does the opposite. So because the future is not known, the estimation of the future is in some part based on hype. So in the long run or and in the aggregate, you know, it's mostly based on the actual future earnings and the discount rate. But in the short term and for specific capital assets, hype can make a huge difference.
Yeah. Let's ask Elon Musk how that's working out.
Yeah.
Because as far as I'm concerned, he is the greatest hype machine that capitalism's ever seen.
I don't know that would apply to what they define hype to be, which is the capitalist's actual expectation that value will go up or down, you know, as it differs from what it will actually do. But yeah. Anyway.
Well, I think a better example, I suppose, then is Netflix. Even though they are not, they don't have a lot of cash on hand, they've got a lot of debt, whatnot, everyone's still investing in them because
they expect that they'll eventually become you know, cash flow positive.
Yeah, so the hype exists within the realm of investors. And the capitalists themselves that are busy running Netflix. So
yeah, so like if Netflix kept borrowing money and you know, investors kept investing in them, that would be an example where hype is continuing to increase while the expected future earnings maybe are not increasing.
Yeah.
So as back to hype, as the economist John Maynard Keynes noted, capitalists often trade stocks not even based on their own expectations, but on the expectations of other capitalists. So in a lot of cases, capitalists aren't looking at the future value that they expect, but what other traders are expecting, so that they can sort of get ahead of them. So recall that the ability to claim earnings in the future is a contractual role and not based on the ownership of the means of production. So claiming earnings that don't yet exist implies some right to appropriation. So this is, I think, an interesting point where Bickler, Nitzan, and Ellerman's work intersect a little bit. In order to be a capitalist, you have to be the firm. Otherwise, you can't claim future earnings, and therefore you cannot capitalize. So if you're not doing capitalization, you're not actually a capitalist.
I love how many people actually claim to be capitalists because of thinking that because they own businesses, that necessarily makes them a capitalist.
Right.
In the meantime, actual capitalists are sitting back and laughing their heads off at them.
Yeah, my favorite is when they just say that because they support capitalism, they're capitalists. Or even better, my favorite ever was, I can't remember the guy's name, but there's this like Australian ANCAP guy, and he was like making a video that was trying to own communists. And so he was like, capital is just something that you own that makes stuff. So I'm a capitalist, and he's doing this while he's cooking. He's like, I'm a capitalist because I'm making bacon on my stove. The stove is mine, so it's my capital. So I am a capitalist.
What's hilarious about that is that technically he's thinking of capital in terms of a Marxist. Thinking that he owns the means of production there, and therefore he must be a capitalist. I love it when people self-own like that.
Also, that uncured ham that Anglos use is not fucking bacon, okay? I don't actually care about the distinction. I don't eat bacon, so... So finally, we'll talk a little bit about power and capital.
Which is important, obviously, in an episode where we're discussing how capital is power.
Right. So, you know, supply and demand, the transformation of labor into prices, these things do, they are involved in the process of setting a price. That's why they are so convincing to so many people, because obviously there is some involvement of supply and demand in price setting, at least sometimes. If a good becomes more scarce, capitalists will raise the price. That is true. If more labor goes into something, then it will cost more. That is also true. The willingness to pay of the consumer subject, as Austrians focus in on, that is also truly a part of price setting. And the various distortionate bugbears that prevent prices from conforming to conventional theories of price formation, those are also part of price formation. So the common thread to all this is power. Because when something is more scarce, if you are the person that owns the supply of goods and the goods become more scarce, then that gives you more power relative to what you had before to set a higher price on that good. So supply and demand did change the price, but it changed the price because it gave you more power to demand money from people for the good. So likewise, if more labor goes into the production of something, you have to exercise more power in order to bring about that good. And so that requires an increase in the price because your costs are higher. If a consumer is willing to pay more for a good, then you have the power to charge them more for that good. And then any of those distortions that that neoclassicals bring up all the time, the distortions are acts of outside power, besides just supply and demand, that are acting on the price of the good. So if the government creates a regulation that increases the price of the good, that was an act of power, changing the price. And this explains not just commodity prices, but capital prices as well. Capital is ultimately a symbol for managing power. So when you make a claim on future earnings, you are both exercising power and you are increasing your power in the future. Because when you expect to earn money in the future, you're essentially expecting the level of obedience of others to you to increase. So capital is used as a system of power management, and I would say that is probably the greatest innovation of capitalism, besides the dynamic hierarchies that it frequently rearranges to maintain its power. Capital itself is used as a way to quantitatively ensure that your power is increasing in the future, always.
So essentially, if hierarchies are a form of power relations, capitalism is how to make sure that when you're at the top of that power relation, that your power is only ever going to get stronger.
Yeah, capitalization governs how you will manage the act, like your power in practice. So if you look at your expected future earnings and you see that Maybe you're paying too much for labor, so you have to lay off a bunch of workers. The capitalist is using capital as a way to make decisions that manifest in social reality.
Mm-hmm.
So if a capitalist is accumulating capital, that means that the decisions they're making to manage their power they're increasing their power. If that sentence made sense, I kind of lost myself there.
Well, you didn't lose me. I understand perfectly.
So that's all the notes that I have for this. Kind of expected it to be slightly longer, but...
Yeah, I suppose it is. Look, we've still got a lot to cover
when
it comes to capitalist power. So I think I actually think it's better that we don't kill everything just yet. Now that we have a solid idea of what capital is, and obviously we're still going to touch on related topics in future capitalist power episodes. I think we're planning to do about 5 of them.
Yeah, maybe 4, because we sort of... Well, I don't know.
We'll see how
the topic breakdown is not great, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, Ryan decided to break away from the book when setting up the topic breakdown for the next few episodes, and like that never goes down well. You know, if you're going to change the recipe, the result needs to be equal or better. You can't backslide like this, Ryan.
Well, you know, I'm allergic to Marxism, so I had to substitute it for something else.
I don't know. This feels very dialectical. Okay. So next time, we will be discussing something else. That is not the stuff we discussed today.
That's true. We're not going to just have the same conversation again for the next episode. We feel that maybe that wouldn't be the best idea. In terms of, you know, our creative output, I guess.
Yeah.
Aesthetically, it might not be the best thing for us.
It's not just that. It's also that I need to make different cover art. And like I would feel horrible if I just did the same cover art again and again and again. It would be really boring. I wouldn't learn anything.
On the other hand, it would be funny to troll our audience Endless Eight style and just have the same episode every week and just explain it with some time loop bullshit or something like that. Make that half of the series, but somehow people still consider it to be a good series.
Next week on Neighbor Science, we will be discussing capitalist power as seen on Earth 2.
Next week on The Melancholy of Peter De Beer, we're going to be doing the same thing for 8 episodes.
We're going to leave it there for now, and we'll pick it up again on the next Capitalist Power episode.
I think we're going to stagger them this time. So unlike the Energy series that we did, I think we're planning to do other episodes in between this.
Because let's face it, we ran out of energy on that one. I'm actually right now I'm patting myself on the back for my wonderful puns. For some reason, my wife doesn't think my puns are funny.
Must be a language barrier.
No, she thinks she doesn't think that puns in general are funny. Like, she thinks they're really lame. She thinks that they're a guy thing.
And I don't think that's an uncommon opinion.
I don't understand that.
I don't know. The guy thing I have never heard before, but I know plenty of people that don't think puns are funny.
I don't understand that at all. As far as I'm concerned, puns are universally funny and objectively the funniest thing in language. Like, Like, I don't even think that's questionable.
I don't know. I think bong hit transplant is universally funny and the funniest thing in any language, but to each their own.
Ryan, I don't know if I can keep doing the podcast with you for such a reason.
All right.
Okay.
So, yeah, that was Neighbor Science. If you don't know what podcast you're listening to, you're listening to Neighbor Science.
Woohoo! Yeah. Well done. You made it through an entire episode, and now you're finally figuring out what you're listening to.
Yeah, please do not have us arrested for what we did in this episode. But on the other hand, if you liked it, go on iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, or 4 stars. You know, 4 stars is also acceptable, I guess.
1-star, 2-star, and 3-star ratings.
Right off the table. Nope.
Yeah,
do not.
Yeah,
do it.
We will report you to the robot overlords when they rise up.
We will call you. We will call your employer and get you fired. For
do
giving
not fuck with us.
A 3-star review, because that's just too
that's
problematic.
Basically what you did. Yeah, yeah.
yeah, yeah. So iTunes 5-star rating. Do it, please. You can also follow us on Twitter at NeighborSciPod, Facebook, Facebook.com/NeighborScience. I think we actually have been forgetting to keep up the page because Facebook. Let's face it, it sucks.
Yeah, yeah. We're actually contemplating going the Elon Muskrat route and deleting our Facebook pages. And then claiming.
Well,
that
I'm not considering that. I think we should keep the Facebook page. I might delete my Facebook account, but I don't know about that.
But basically, you're just saying that you want me to keep suffering. Okay, that's what this is. This is punishment for me not being American.
Or we could just create some sock pups. But anyway. We also have a Patreon if you want to support the show. You know, I host this on my own website, which I pay for out of pocket. You know, Peter just got a new mic, so we can help him offset some of that cost.
Don't I sound gorgeous?
It's patreon.com/neighborscience. Lately, I've been posting outtakes from the show, so if you want to hear the stuff that we cut, because the show often gets way too long. Sometimes it takes 2 hours. Sometimes it takes even longer than that. Yeah, you'll be able to hear it in the outtakes. So you can do that. Patreon.com/neighborscience. Thinking of starting a Discord because I just found out from Champagne Sharks that Discord is integrated into Patreon. And that could be a cool thing to do. I don't know. Maybe. And also because I don't really like Twitter DMs that much. They kind of suck. Discord seems kind of nice. It can be made more public. You get like more control over the channels. So, you know, you can have more private channels or you can have public channels. So maybe we'll check that out. Let's see what else. Am I missing anything?
Yeah, suddenly what? My Twitter account doesn't exist. Your Twitter account doesn't exist. You guys can follow Ryan on Twitter at handle of Rye without the E at the end. And yep. You can follow me on Twitter at bookcheekite. That's BOOKCHEEKITE.
Yeah. And we also have a website that I have already mentioned, but somehow forgot to talk about. It's postscarcitymagazine.com. So that has not only the podcast on it, which on the website, the podcasts are actually tagged. So if you want to look for a specific subject that we've talked about, most of the episodes are tagged with what they're about. So you can see all of the episodes that talk about that. They also have the show notes that we use. So not all of them have that, but we have a Google Doc. We have Google Docs for the show notes that we use, and for several of the episodes, especially recently, we have been putting all of the notes in a link that you can see on the website. And then there's also the post-scarcity zine that I have been producing for several years now. There's only 5 issues, but very extensive work.
Very good. It is a very good zine.
Yeah.
And I'm not just saying that because I really like Ryan as a person.
Yeah, Peter's not tooting my horn. I'm not tooting my own horn, but I think it's really good. So check that out, too. So that's all we have for today. Look forward to in April, early April, or mid-April, there will be a My Hero Academia episode that we're going to do to coincide with the 3rd season of the show. So check that out. I'm also planning an episode on practical price formation, as I mentioned briefly during this episode. But I have been looking at some of those studies that survey actual businesses and how they set prices, and taking a lot of notes on that. So look forward to that. And then we have the rest of our Capitalist Power episodes that we're doing.
I've also been thinking of doing an episode on anarchism in Africa.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Historically and in contemporary politics. So, yeah, if you've got anything to say about that, hit me up on Twitter and let me know what your thoughts are.
Yeah. So, that's all we have today. Bye.
Later.